This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, this is the Washington Post for Monday, May 13th. I'm Claire, reading for Radio Reading Services of the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. The top story today: in the 10 months since his daughter was born, Ruslan Kochak has hardly left her side. He held baby Isabella in the hospital before his wife did. Lately, he's learned to keep her steady as she practices her first steps, but he has never seen her. 3 months before Isabella's birth, Kochak, 47, was blinded when shrapnel from a Russian shell pierced the left side of his skull in Chasiv-Yar, the small city where he was fighting as a soldier in eastern Ukraine. Kochak was once a tattoo artist with his own salon, but his injury has robbed him of his profession, his hobbies, his routine, and most painfully, of the chance to see his daughter grow up. On the front lines of Russia's bloody war, Ukrainian troops are killed and wounded daily, scarring and maiming a generation of young people. Many, like Kochak, voluntarily joined the military in the first days of the invasion in 2022. Severe eye injuries are pervasive. At least 1,000 soldiers have been blinded in the past 2 years, said Anna Pertova, a lawmaker who is advocating for soldiers who have lost their vision. Tatiana Lechnevoka, head of ophthalmology at a Kyiv hospital that treats soldiers and civilians, said the 30 beds in her ward are always full. While medical advances have improved treatment for many war injuries, including with enhanced prosthetic limbs, little can be done for those who lose vision in both eyes and must learn to navigate the world without sight. Ukraine has not yet adapted to its growing blind population. Guide dogs are uncommon. Many streetlights do not beep for pedestrians, and drivers often park on city sidewalks, creating dangerous obstacles. Some wounded Ukrainians are struggling with all of these challenges while also facing parenthood blind. For 9 years before his injury, Kochak and his wife, Yulia, who works in a bank, dreamed of starting a family. She was 6 months pregnant when she visited her husband in the hospital and told him that what his doctors had explained to her. His vision was gone forever. Kochak's head injury could easily have been fatal. He lost one eye immediately and had to crawl to an evacuation point where he lost consciousness. He survived but woke up in the hospital to a blur that soon faded into darkness. For months, he struggled to accept his situation. It was a daily process of finding the sense in living, he said. It's like fighting with yourself. Then Isabella was born. In the hospital, Yulia described Isabella to him: pink skin, red hair, and bright blue eyes. When she said blue eyes, I just melted, Kochak said. He knows that her hair has since turned blonde, and he likes to imagine that too. I can only touch her face and picture her image in my head, he said. I'm touching her face a lot. Fatherhood, Yulia acknowledged, is probably what kept him alive. Kochak still hasn't found a job he can do that satisfies his creative passions, but he has found some solace in rock climbing, a sport he had never tried before losing his vision. Now he regularly visits a gym in Kyiv. The owner, who drives him to and from the sessions, calls out directions to help him navigate the rock wall that most climbers scale by following colored patterns. Kochak said he is trying to stay healthy and active for himself and also for Isabella. Every father wants to set an example for their kid, he said. Denis Abdulim, 35, already had 2 sons when he left his home in Bielaturska, a small city near Kyiv, in March 2022, and joined the military. His wife, Lysia, took their boys to Lithuania for safety. By that April, Abdulim was in the eastern city of Severodonetsk, where Russian forces encircled his brigade, he said. They were hit with artillery, cluster munitions, and aviation bombs. Abdulim took cover in a building. He didn't hear the drone that spotted them or the whistle of the mortar that followed. Shrapnel pierced his skull through his left ear and exited his right eye. The soldiers in the building, all wounded, tried to patch each other up while awaiting evacuation. In a hospital in Dnipro, Abdulim said he waited days for bandages to be changed. Eventually, he was sent to Kyiv, and Alicia brought their sons, Vadim and David, to visit. even though he couldn't see them. Their innocence about his injuries left him hopeful. One was excited to ride in his wheelchair. The other wanted to play with the adjustable hospital bed. I cannot explain the happiness, he said. The boys, now 9 and 6, were 2 years younger when he last saw them, and that's how they will stay in his mind. I'm very grateful he had a chance to see them, Alicia said, in their living room on a recent Saturday, as their cat Usyk circled around their legs and the boys ran around with toys. Their eye color, body types, features, he saw them in real life. The boys struggled to understand their dad's blindness. The younger one, David, once took of Abdulin's prosthetic blue eyes and attached it to the head of his red Play-Doh octopus. They bring Abdulin books to read and pictures to see. Sometimes when they ask him to assemble a toy, he gets frustrated. He wishes he could teach them to box, his favorite sport. We didn't explain the whole situation, Alicia said. We tell them he got injured at war. Abdulin used to work in a warehouse, a job he can no longer do. Last year, he trained as a massage therapist with help from PORT, an organization founded by Pertova, the lawmaker who helps blind veterans adapt. For now, Abdulin borrows a space to serve his few clients, but hopes to open his own studio. Before hearing about massage school, he said, I had no idea what a blind person could do. His work has given him an important sense of purpose after a difficult recovery. Alicia used to comfort him through panic attacks about his blindness. He also suffered from nightmares. Even good dreams always have a bad ending, he said, because he wakes up blind. He recently had surgery to prepare for eye implants that will help prevent infections and give the appearance of natural eyes, but he still holds out hope that he will see again. I don't want to live my whole life blind, he said. Ivan Soroka, 27, and his wife Vladislavia, 26, met online in April 2022. At military positions outside Kyiv, he climbed trees to find a signal to message her. They finally met in person, and I fell in love with her green eyes immediately, he said. By May, they were engaged. When he left for the front in June, I promised her I'd come back, he said. In August of that year, while Soroka's unit was retreating from near Bakhmut, a mortar exploded between him and his close friend Yura, who died, leaving behind a wife and 2 children. Soroka was badly wounded in his face and legs. He lost sight in both eyes. His biggest fear, he said, was that he would be a burden to Vladislava. The biggest surprise, he added, was that she told him they would overcome their challenges together. They married last September. Last month, between air raid sirens in Kyiv, Vladislava gave birth to a boy, the first time her doctor delivered a baby for a blind parent. The doctor handed Soroka the scissors, and he cut the umbilical cord. They named the dark-haired baby Svyatoslav. 3 days later, family and friends, including some of Soroka's fellow soldiers, arrived to congratulate the new parents before they returned home. Soroka carefully held his son, cradling his head in the same hands that once held a gun. It's scary to hold a baby in your hands, he said. If you can see, it might not be so scary, but if you can't see him, such little hands, little legs. It was especially good news that he was a boy, the visitor said. Svyatoslav looks like his father, and Ukraine is running out of men. Israeli forces continued to advance on the southern city of Rafah on Sunday and launched another operation against Hamas in the north, setting off a desperate scramble among war-weary civilians across Gaza. Humanitarian agencies warned that no place was safe and that essential aid had nearly run out, almost a week after Israel captured and shut down the border crossing with Egypt. The expanding evacuations in Rafah, where Israel had ordered more than 1 million Palestinians to seek shelter from fighting early in the war, signaled a possible push into the heart of the city, a move that could prompt Washington, Israel's staunchest ally, to freeze offensive weapons shipments after months of faltering ceasefire negotiations. We cannot, will not support an operation in Rafah, the major military operation, in the absence of a credible plan to protect civilians. And they, Israel, still haven't delivered, Secretary of State Antony Blinken told CBS's Face the Nation on Sunday. On a call between National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan and his Israeli counterpart Tzviki Hengvi, they discussed alternative courses of action to ensure the defeat of Hamas everywhere in Gaza, according to a White House readout. Mr. Hanby confirmed that Israel is taking U.S. concerns into account, the statement said. But Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has publicly brushed off President Biden's warnings, arguing that Israeli forces must destroy Hamas's remaining battalions in Rafah to eliminate the threat posed by the militant group after its deadly October 7th attack on southern Israel. Israeli officials concede that in the absence of a viable post-war plan, Hamas has already been able to regroup in parts of the north that were cleared by the Israel Defense Forces last year, such as the Jabalia refugee camp, which the IDF shelled late Saturday, hours after issuing new evacuation orders. The heavy bombardment sent 29-year-old lawyer Mohammed Al-Harthini and some 30 family members fleeing from their shelter in Jabalia, he told the Washington Post by phone Sunday. They made their way to western Gaza City, much of which has been reduced to ruins. People are living the same experience as before, he said, of the renewed fighting. Sunday's flight marked his third displacement in 7 months. He had nowhere to go, he said. The situation was worse than the human mind can imagine. In a statement, the IDF said its troops operated overnight in Jabalia after airstrikes on about 30 Hamas targets, a rerun of a larger operation in November, when Israeli forces encircled the camp and claimed victory after weeks of intense combat with militants. In the south, some 300,000 people have fled Rafah since the IDF first issued evacuation orders for the city on May 6, according to the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees. Dozens of civilians have been killed in shelling there, according to Palestinian health officials. More than 35,000 Palestinians have been killed in 7 months of war, according to the Gaza Health Ministry, which does not distinguish between civilians and combatants, but says the majority of the dead are women and children. The Israeli military says it has killed 13,000 fighters, but has not provided supporting evidence. IDF spokesman Daniel Hagari described the Rafah operation early Sunday as precise and limited in scope, saying that Israeli forces were avoiding the city's densely populated areas. The IDF said Sunday that it had killed 10 Hamas militants in Rafah and dismantled a series of tunnel shafts. The IDF operation had turned the city from an overcrowded place of last refuge into a dangerous ghost town, panicked Gazans told the Post. Mawasi, a small coastal area in southern Gaza where Israel has directed civilians to flee, is ill-equipped to handle a new influx of families, according to relief agencies. The barren area on the outskirts of Khan Yunis was already home to 400,000 people in tents, the United Nations estimated, and has been shelled repeatedly in recent months, even though Israel deemed it a humanitarian zone. It's chaotic, said Ricardo Pires, a spokesperson for UNICEF, the UN Children's Agency. We have been warning for months that Al-Mawasi is not a safe option. It is a narrow strip of beach on the coast that lacks the most basic infrastructure, like toilets and running water, needed to sustain the population. Mohammed Al-Masri, 40, and his family had been sheltering at a school in Rafah after being driven from their home in the north. On Wednesday, they made the hours-long trek to Mawasi, mostly on foot, he told the Post by phone. Al-Masri, his wife, and 5 children are now sharing a single tent. Everything is so expensive, he said. We are just trying to get by. In photos and videos shared by Al-Masri, rows and rows of makeshift tents fill the flat, sandy area. There is no source of water or other humanitarian services nearby, he said. A full-blown famine is already underway in the north and is spreading south, the World Food Program warned on May 5th. A day later, Israeli forces seized the Rafah crossing, Gaza's most vital entry point for aid and relief workers. With nothing allowed in for nearly a week, aid agencies say they are dangerously low on food and fuel. Operations on the ground are very stretched and highly unsafe for humanitarian workers, Pires said. We are running out of stock on whatever was pre-positioned before Rafah closed. We are trying to negotiate different crossings, but no sign that any of it will work, he added. The needs are increasing significantly, not only for Rafah, but again in the north with new fighting in Jabalia. WFP spokesperson Ali Zaki told the Post that the agency has already been forced to reduce rations and even those were at risk of stopping in the next few days. Israeli authorities on Sunday announced the opening of a new Western Erez crossing into northern Gaza, though it can handle only a fraction of the traffic that flows through the southern crossings. Dozens of trucks of flour were coordinated from the port of Ashdod on behalf of the WFP organization after undergoing security checks, the IDF said in a statement. The number of trucks entering the Palestinian territory is just a trickle of the roughly 500 that Israel allowed to enter before the war, according to the United Nations. Aid agencies say onerous Israeli restrictions and bombardments have crippled humanitarian efforts in Gaza. The IDF on Sunday accused Hamas of firing rockets toward Kerem Shalom, another crossing in the south, to prevent aid from reaching Gazans. The standoff with Congress, rooted in taxpayer privacy, has prompted the IRS to cut off a form of child support for families in at least 10 Native American tribes, a scenario that could be replicated in all 50 states as soon as this fall, affecting hundreds of thousands more households. Every year, more than 1 million tax refunds are garnished at the request of state governments and rerouted to custodial parents. Those efforts are a key piece of the nation's child support pipeline, representing $2 billion, or 6% of such payments, in 2022. For many families, those users are the only source of child support. But federal law doesn't allow Native American tribes to collect overdue child support through the tax system, and the IRS has suspended a workaround that formally allowed some tribes to seize those funds. Meanwhile, a separate concern over states' data sharing could upend the system more broadly. Most states use contractors to retrieve and reroute federal refunds to custodial parents, but the IRS is supposed to share certain taxpayer information with only governments, not third parties, a role it overlooked for years for the purpose of sending child support payments. Last year, the agency changed course and said it would follow the data sharing restrictions in all instances, notifying states that they had until October 2024 to submit plans, showing how they will comply with privacy rules that most states say would be too costly to follow. That would affect a large swath of the 13 million children, of whom about half live below or near federal poverty lines, covered by child support agreements. For the 2023 filing season, the average federal tax refund was $2,850. While most observers expect either the IRS or Congress to resolve the problem before it gets to the state level, the IRS already has cut off hundreds of tribal members. IRS officials did not respond to questions from the Washington Post about why states were given time to address the issue, while tribes have already been denied access to tax refunds. Kimberly Brockie, a member of the Gros Ventre tribe in Montana, says she has struggled to get child support from the father of her three children since their 2007 split. The last time was 2021, when she got his $1,600 tax refund. He still owes her more than $30,000, she said. Her ex confirmed the debt. He told the Post he has withheld child support because of serious disputes with Brockie over parenting decisions. "I put myself in debt trying to make ends meet with three kids," said Brockie, who manages a college bookstore. "It's hard. I'm still trying to claw back out of that debt." Why should he be able to live good now because of whatever the IRS has going on? It's punishing the people that don't get help from the other parent. Willowa Sis Horn, who runs the child support program for Brockie's tribe, said the tribe has about 300 cases, but only 56 paying parents. "We wanted to get access to tax intercepts to help bring our huge debt down," she said. Nearly every child support program in the country employs contractors for such tasks as maintaining computerized case logs, manning call centers for parents, or communicating with employers about garnishing wages. One company, Maximus, told the Post that it has contracts with 23 state programs and it has worked with all 50 states at some point. More than 5 million Americans pay child support, according to the Census Bureau, and about a third of them do not pay regularly. The median monthly payment is $374. Child support professionals have been urging Congress to change the law to allow the use of contractors. The House held a hearing on the topic last year, but has yet to hold a vote. Earlier this year, IRS Commissioner Danny Werfel told lawmakers he would consider delaying enforcement if Congress doesn't act by October. That hasn't reassured state officials, many of whom are perplexed by the newfound urgency surrounding contractors. Some have linked it to the 2023 conviction of Charles Littlejohn, the former IRS contractor who leaked the confidential tax returns of former President Donald Trump to the New York Times, and the returns of thousands of wealthy Americans to ProPublica, and was sentenced to 5 years in prison. However, the IRS announced its enforcement plan months before Littlejohn's arrest. The 2019 Taxpayer First Act, which was passed years before the Littlejohn case emerged, required the agency to more tightly monitor contractors' access to data, according to an IRS official who spoke on the condition of anonymity, because they were not authorized to publicly discuss the agency's decision-making. My view is that there's been increased interest in Congress and increased pressure on the IRS to not have any breaches, and sometimes they've been associated with contractors, and there's the whole ProPublica staff, said Kate Cooper Richardson, who runs Oregon's Child Support Program. Richardson was president of a National Association of Child Support Directors when the IRS announced plans to block contractor access. That was a bomb dropped on all the states, Richardson said. We can't mitigate this. We can't bring all functions in-house. The IRS flagged Oregon's program for storing case data on a contractor's servers rather than those owned by the state, Richardson said. If I got rid of them, I would have had to bring all of that in-house, which I just don't have the capacity for, she said. It would take years to do. Richardson said it would cost $15 million to set up state-owned servers and more than $2 million a year to run them, which is much more than the cost of contractors. The use of contractors varies from state to state. Kansas has almost entirely privatized its child support system, while other states rarely employ contractors. Colorado uses a contractor, SMI, to help send checks to parents, said Child Support Director Larry Desbian. These companies are very skilled at doing this. They have tremendous software, he said. For a state to take over those operations would be a major undertaking. But even states without outside help have been flagged by the IRS. In North Dakota, Director James Fleming said the IRS told him that he was inappropriately sharing taxpayer data because he shared information with the state treasurer's office. We don't issue checks, our state treasurer does, Fleming said. I've got to involve other state agencies in order to cut mom that check. The IRS says they're not child support, they're contractors. You scratch your head and say, how in blazes am I going to get this money back to her? Some tribes have gotten around data sharing rules by having states submit their list of delinquent parents to the IRS. In 2021, North Dakota collected $500,000 in tax offsets for tribal families on tribes' behalf, Fleming said. But then the IRS said such arrangements were illegal. Tribes that used to access tax refunds through Fleming's office were cut off. In Wisconsin, Tribal Child Support Assistant Director Sunny Bissonette said about 700 families in the Lac Court Orleans tribe lost access to federal tax offsets. The average annual payment was more than $1,200. In any given year, a tax refund was the only child support that 30% to 55% of families in the program received. What it means is it's less money in families, households, less money for school clothes, Bissonette said. In the rural community, Bissonette said she sees some fathers who owe child support to more than one mother, sometimes one who is a member of the tribe and one who is not. Because of the IRS change, the non-tribal mothers are now getting the full tax refund, while the tribal mothers get no child support. The disparity frustrates many on Native American reservations. Tribes are already economically depressed areas with extremely high unemployment, said Gerald Thompson, who runs the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe's child support program. With one method some families had of receiving relief, it's further oppressing people living in the area. Austin Casto, a member of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe in North Dakota, received little child support for years following her divorce. Then, circumstances changed. Her ex-husband had more children, she said, which pumped up the size of his tax refund. His 2021 and 2022 refunds were garnished, yielding $5,100 and $9,700 respectively, she said. Casto's ex-husband did not respond to messages from the Post, But Thompson, who runs her tribe's child support program, confirmed that Castro formally received her ex's tax refunds and no longer can. With that first check, Castro said she paid for their daughter, now 16, to get braces. Anticipating a similar payment for the 2023 tax year, she told her 13-year-old son he would be next. Then her tribe was kicked out of the IRS child support offset program, and she just told her son he wouldn't be getting braces anytime soon. He just moped around for months, she said. Without the tax money, we can't afford it, she said. It's $235 a month for his braces for 2 years. There's just no way right now. The remote stretch of public grazing land in southeastern Montana has hardly changed since homesteading days. But underneath this windswept expanse lies a hidden asset in high demand. Thousands of acres of porous rock where oil company executives say greenhouse gas could be piped in from afar and stored forever. ExxonMobil and the Biden administration see in the grassy 100,000 acres a launch pad for one of the world's most audacious climate experiments, a plan to take emissions spewing from power plants and factories and trap them underground where they cannot contribute to global warming. The scheme is inching forward despite criticism it will permit polluters to keep polluting while slowing the transition to solar and wind energy. And now sponsors face the additional hurdle of intense local opposition. In the ranching community of Carter County, Montana, the prospect of shipping in all that carbon pollution and injecting it underneath an area called Snowy River is about as popular as an outbreak of hoof and mouth disease. The question I keep hearing is, why are they making us the dumping ground for the rest of the country? Said Rod Talk, chairman of the Carter County Board of Commissioners, and a descendant of homesteaders who more than a century ago settled his family ranch. Not a single constituent I know wants this. Such tensions are emerging nationwide, throwing an industrial-sized wrench into the quest by the White House and major energy companies to advance a vast network of carbon capture infrastructure across the country. It would involve tens of thousands of miles of new pipelines and scores of remote storage sites on the scale of Snowy River, targeted because the porous rock underneath them can act like a carbon sponge. This vision for using technology to reverse climate change was once viewed widely as far-fetched. Now, proposals to divert carbon dioxide from smokestacks to vast subterranean wells are regarded by the White House, the United Nations, and the International Energy Agency as crucial to preserving any hope of meeting the world's climate goals. The Biden administration's plans to zero out emissions from the power grid by 2035 increasingly hinges on the success of colossal carbon capture deployment. The government has made billions of dollars of incentives available to motivate companies like ExxonMobil and Chevron to rapidly develop it. The urgency is only increasing as a surge in forecasted energy use driven by the insatiable electricity appetite of artificial intelligence developers and a national boom in manufacturing is delaying retirement of old fossil fuel power plants and pushing utilities to build new ones. New clean energy like wind and solar is not coming online quickly enough to meet all the projected demand, prompting government to lean on plans to stow away carbon pollution. We have to stop fossil fuels from causing global warming before the world stops using fossil fuels. Miles Allen, a climate scientist at the University of Oxford in England, who has served on the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, said recently at CERAWeek, an agency conference sponsored by S&P Global, "This is the way to stop fossil fuels from causing global warming." But even early carbon capture projects are floundering. Hostile community reception is undermining plans from the Gulf Coast of Louisiana to the prairies of South Dakota. Energy companies racing ahead are facing tough questions around safety, environmental impact, and technological viability. In Montana, the Federal Bureau of Land Management in 2022 identified the Snowy River site as one of the first stretches of public land that may be suitable for carbon sequestration. ExxonMobil wants to inject 450 million cubic feet of carbon dioxide per day into the ground. The company is not identifying where that gas would come from, but one likely source is a carbon dioxide pipeline currently used to support oil and gas extraction projects. The pressurized gas is used to force fossil fuels to the surface. That pipeline is connected to a large ExxonMobil natural gas plant 500 miles away in Wyoming. ExxonMobil says Snowy River's storage capacity is equal to a year's worth of polluting greenhouse gas from 1.6 million cars. That pipeline is connected to a large ExxonMobil Legacy energy companies like ExxonMobil are eager to deploy technologies that could extend the life of fossil fuels by mitigating their role in global warming. Plus, federal incentives are potentially lucrative. The single Montana project could generate as much as $12.7 billion in federal tax subsidies. ExxonMobil took it over when it acquired carbon capture and pipeline developer Denbury for $4.9 billion in November. Company officials say they have not yet made a final decision to build in Montana, but assessing the project's viability, they say, requires they get the BLM permit to store the carbon now so they can do testing on site. Montana Governor Greg Gianforte supports the company's plan. "We are fully committed to working with the community," said Kathleen Ash, CEO of Denbury, now a fully owned ExxonMobil subsidiary. "This is a safe and proven technology." Many in the local community see something else. Big corporations looking for a payday, partnering with an administration, turning a blind eye to a flawed technology. They point to problems that carbon capture projects are encountering around the world, such as Chevron's sprawling Gorgon operation at a massive natural gas field in Australia. It is not trapping even half the carbon dioxide planned amid persistent technological troubles. BLM officials counter that carbon dioxide has been safely injected underground as part of the oil production process for decades. They call the projects an important tool for fighting climate change and advancing the administration's agenda to erase emissions. "They are presenting this as a climate solution, and I don't know that it is," said Liz Barber, who manages Cinch Buckle Ranch, an operation bordering Snowy River that uses low-impact conservation-focused agricultural practices. "The only thing I do know is that it is part of their plan to continue producing oil and gas." Barber is among several ranchers working with a grassroots group called the Northern Plains Resource Council to fight the project. Local landowners with sharply contrasting politics and views on climate change are finding common cause in the battle. The council's argument that carbon capture is an unproven government handout to large out-of-state corporations was echoed repeatedly in interviews in this county. Of 1,415 people defined by wide open spaces and dirt roads, where visiting a neighbor can involve an hour-long journey. Carter County cast 89% of its ballots for Donald Trump in 2020. "Many of us are willing to accept the premise that this is a dangerous compound that needs to be gotten rid of," said Jack Owen, a 72-year-old who ranches on land his ancestors homesteaded. "The question is, why here?" ExxonMobil's assurances that the project would be almost entirely underground with little noticeable impact on the landscape are met skeptically. Local landowners counter that upgrading the roads, drilling wells, and installing new pipelines would take a heavy toll on the landscape. "The scale of carbon that must be effectively stored nationwide to make a dent in global warming is enormous," Claude Letourneau, the CEO of Svante, one of North America's leading carbon capture technology firms, said, containing the emissions created by manufacturing processes like cement and steelmaking could require 10,000 plants to trap the gas, compress it, and then pipe or truck it to places like Snowy River. An ambitious proposal in the Midwest recently collapsed. The proposed 1,200-mile Heartland Greenway pipeline was supposed to span five states, bringing 15 million tons of carbon dioxide captured at ethanol plants each year to storage sites where it could be buried. The project proposed by Navigator CO2 appeared to have early advantages. Ethanol plants emit uncontaminated carbon dioxide that is less complicated to capture and compress than the gas from other industries. And many landowners along the proposed route already hosted oil and gas pipelines. But community opposition was intense. Landowners and local regulators worried about safety and environmental fallout. The CEO of Williams, one of the biggest natural gas pipeline companies in the world, said in an interview that even his board chairman, who owns farmland in Iowa, wants nothing to do with the carbon dioxide pipelines. He said, "I don't want it damaging this very valuable cropland," Williams CEO Alan Armstrong said. Navigator CO2 canceled the Heartland Greenway project in October. It blamed the unpredictable nature of the regulatory and government process involved. Armstrong is one of many energy executives who said the project faltered because the developers spent too little time educating communities about the technology and talking through concerns. Companies more practiced in securing permits for pipelines, it was argued, would win local buy-in. But it is not turning out that way for ExxonMobil in Montana. Assurances from ExxonMobil that disruption would be minimal are met with worries that the project will disrupt the ecosystem, leave water tables vulnerable to the leaching of carbon dioxide, and create a safety hazard. A rupture in the existing pipeline several years ago left one Carter County ranch looking as if a meteor had hit it. Pictures from 2018 show a deep truck-sized crater in the ground covered with what looks like dry ice residue caused by the compressed carbon dioxide combustion. Since that time, another major pipeline accident had dire consequences for the town of Sauteria, Mississippi. The pipeline was also owned by Denbury, the ExxonMobil subsidiary. The 2020 rupture filled the air above a section of the pipeline with dangerous amounts of carbon dioxide, resulting in a medical emergency that sent 45 people to the hospital with respiratory and other problems, according to a U.S. Department of Transportation investigation. The gas caused three men driving through the area to pass out in their car and the engine to stop running. Fire department officials had to break the windows to pull them out, according to local 911 call tapes and public records obtained by the nonprofit Climate Investigation Center. Residents desperately called 911 for help. In one case, a mother reported that her child couldn't breathe, and in another, a caller said her friend was on the ground shaking and drooling as if suffering a seizure. Denbury paid a $2.8 billion fine as part of a settlement with the federal government, in which it did not admit to any of the alleged violations or risks identified. Some of the residents injured in the incident and their doctors say they are still suffering serious ailments because of it. ExxonMobil officials said new training protocols for emergency responders have been initiated since the incident. They say that there has never been a fatality associated with piping carbon dioxide and that accidents involving such pipelines are rare. The company said it also supports stepped-up federal safety regulations amid the planned expansion of carbon dioxide pipelines. Energy companies say they are undeterred. Among the projects inching forward is one on a 140,000-acre coastal stretch between Houston and the petrochemical facilities of Port Arthur, Texas, called Bayou Bend, where Chevron plans to store as much as 1 billion tons of carbon dioxide. The company is hoping the proximity to factories will make the project more palatable to regulators and landowners. Chevron is also aiming to bury carbon in wells off the coast of Bayou Bend, a plan that alarms marine biologists, but could prove less vulnerable to community protest. A visit to Bayou Bend punctuates the immensity of it all. The site stretches for miles, with the flat grassy landscape interrupted only by the occasional cow chomping on weeds or alligator sunning itself in a marsh. Developers promoting the projects are adamant that most of the work will happen out of sight, with the carbon buried as deep as 10,000 feet and hardly any industrial activity above ground. "This has to happen," said Chris Powers, Chevron's vice president for carbon capture, utilization, and storage, pointing to the forecasting models showing that carbon capture is crucial to curbing global warming. "To make this grow at scale, it is going to take hundreds of projects." Back in Montana, rancher Mike Hansen says if it is all so harmless, project boosters in the nation's capital should just start buying carbon pollution there. "We asked them, why don't you do this under Washington, D.C.," he said. "They told us we can't do that. There are too many people there." That is not saying much for us. Bars of gold, stacks of cash, a Mercedes-Benz convertible, and foreign intelligence officials could all make cameo appearances as Senator Bob Menendez goes on trial Monday for the second time in a decade on federal charges that he used his position and influence to benefit a trio of businessmen who were plying him with luxury gifts. Menendez's previous corruption case featured several bribery allegations, but ended in 2017 with a deadlocked jury in New Jersey. This time, experts say the once powerful chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee faces a tougher task, convincing jurors in Manhattan federal court that he legally obtained the ingots, cash, convertible, and other items seized from his home in 2022. Federal prosecutors allege that Menendez and his wife were being bribed with those gifts by New Jersey businessmen who sought the lawmakers' help, paving the way for lucrative deals they had lined up with the governments of Egypt and Qatar. A 66-page indictment says Menendez tried to pressure law enforcement officials in New Jersey to drop criminal investigations into three people connected to him. The Justice Department says Menendez ultimately became a foreign agent for Egypt, secretly maneuvering to send its U.S. military aid despite resistance in Congress because of the country's alleged human rights violations. He faces 16 felony counts, including bribery, extortion, fraud, obstruction of justice, and acting as a foreign agent, and could spend the rest of his life in prison if convicted on all charges. In the indictment, a team of prosecutors under U.S. Attorney Damian Williams of the Southern District of New York described how one of Menendez's co-defendants, Whale Will Hanna, was granted a monopoly by the Egyptian government as the sole U.S. business authorized to certify halal meat exports to Egypt. Hanna funneled proceeds from that business to Menendez's wife, Nadine Menendez, who set up a shell company to receive payments from a low-show or no-show job, prosecutors allege. Menendez allegedly provided sensitive non-public information to Egyptian officials in exchange, divulging the number of people stationed at the U.S. Embassy in Cairo and their nationalities. Prosecutors say Menendez also ghostwrote a letter on behalf of Egypt to other U.S. senators asking them to release a hold on $300 million in aid to that country. "Tell Will I am going to sign off the sale to Egypt today," Menendez wrote in a 2018 text message to then-girlfriend Nadim that was quoted in the indictment. A reference to a $99 million sale of tank ammunition pending before the Senate. "Note, these tank rounds are for tanks they have had for many years. They are using these in the Sinai for the counterterrorism campaign." Daniel Richmond, an expert on federal bribery law at Columbia Law School, sees a clear distinction between the two corruption cases. What the government really has going for it in this case, unlike the prior one, is the picture of a powerful senator renting his office to a foreign power, he said. Defense attorneys, former prosecutors, and law professors point to other significant differences. The bribes Menendez was accused of taking at his 2017 trial involved more than $700,000 donated to campaign committees supporting his 2012 re-election bid, as well as lavish accommodations on a trip to Paris, undisclosed flights on a private jet, and stays at a villa in the Dominican Republic owned by his friend and co-defendant at the time, Florida eye doctor Salomon Melgen. None of that became Menendez's personal property, the legal experts note, unlike the items seized from his Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey residence. The indictment says Hanna also paid thousands of dollars toward the home's mortgage and mentions several other gifts Menendez and his wife received from the businessmen, including a recliner chair, an elliptical exercise machine, and an air purifier. That tangible evidence, all those luxury goods, gold bars, wads of cash, will no doubt speak volumes in the prosecution's case, said Stuart Green, a Rutgers Law School professor. Menendez and Melgen presented a unified defense 7 years ago, describing a longtime friendship and frequent travels together. This time, one of the individuals who allegedly bribed Menendez has already pleaded guilty and agreed to cooperate with prosecutors. Jose Uribe could take the stand and recount handing Nadine Menendez $15,000 in cash at a parking lot the day before she made a $15,000 down payment on the Mercedes-Benz convertible, as the indictment alleges. Nadine Menendez needed wheels because she had totaled an earlier Mercedes-Benz in a crash that killed a pedestrian in Bagota, New Jersey, as reported by NorthJersey.com. She was not charged in the man's death. Defense attorney suggested in a legal filing that Menendez may cast some blame on his wife, who was indicted alongside him, but is scheduled to be tried separately later this year. A court filing unsealed last month says the attorneys may argue that his wife withheld information from him, or otherwise led him to believe that nothing unlawful was taking place. "I am innocent and will prove so," the 70-year-old senator told constituents in a video message in March, when he announced he would not seek the Democratic nomination to run for a fourth term this November. I am hopeful that my exoneration will take place this summer and allow me to pursue my candidacy as an independent Democrat in the general election. He added, all I can ask of you is to withhold judgment until justice takes place. But Governor Phil Murphy, Senator Cory Booker, and a raft of other high-ranking New Jersey Democrats have called on Menendez to resign. A poll released in March by Monmouth University found that 63% of adults in the state said he should leave office, compared with 28% in a survey after his 2015 indictment. 12 senators in U.S. history have been indicted while in office. 6 have been convicted. 2 of those convictions were later overturned by courts. Menendez is the only senator to be indicted in 2 unrelated criminal investigations. Anytime an individual is indicted 2 times in a row, let's call it public corruption, the odds are not in his favor, said Chris Adams, a defense attorney at the New Jersey law firm Greenbaum Rowe, which was part of Menendez's 2017 legal team. My view as a defense attorney is that this is a much stronger case for the government. The latest indictment quotes liberally from text messages and conversations Menendez and his wife had with each other and with Egyptian officials. At a Washington steakhouse in 2019, Nadine Menendez asked an Egyptian intelligence official dining with the couple, "What else can the love of my life do for you?" the indictment says. The next year, according to the indictment, she sent the same official a text message that said, "Anytime you need anything, you have my number and we will make everything happen." New Jersey real estate developer Fred Daves is Menendez's other co-defendant. In a 2019 text, Nadine Menendez complained to him that Hannah had not paid her what he owed her. The indictment says, with Daves responding, "Nadine, I personally gave Bob a check for September." The senator is also accused of using his influence in 2020 to try to get the U.S. Attorney's Office in New Jersey to drop its prosecution of Daves in a separate fraud case. Daves later pleaded guilty to that offense and was sentenced to probation. Adams and Menendez had several potential avenues of defense. The senator could indeed blame his wife, whom he started dating in 2018 and married in 2020. Nadine Menendez won't be present at her husband's trial because she will be undergoing a medical procedure and then recovering, according to court records, which opens up the possibility of an empty chair defense, Adams said. Menendez also could maintain, as he did in his previous trial, that he was acting in his official capacity. His job is to lobby for constituents, for those who support him, for those who present him with valuable arguments in favor of a position, Adams said. He has already previewed one likely defense claim, saying that as the son of Cuban immigrants, he was raised in an environment where storing large amounts of cash at home was not unusual. The indictment details how federal agents found nearly $500,000 stuffed into envelopes and hidden in clothing, closets, and a safe when they raided his home in 2022. Menendez is represented by Adam Fee, Robert Luskin, A.B. Weitzman, and Yakov Roth, who was part of the legal teams that won victories at the Supreme Court for the New Jersey Bridgegate defendants and for former Virginia Governor Robert McDonnell. In each case, convictions on corruption charges were reversed. The prosecution team includes Christina Clark, Catherine Gauche, Eli Mark, and Paul Montaloni. Another member, Assistant U.S. Attorney Lara Pomerantz, was part of the team that successfully prosecuted Ghislaine Maxwell for sex trafficking young girls on behalf of her paramour financier, Jeffrey Epstein. Prosecutor Daniel Richenthal helped secure a prison sentence of more than 2 years for Michael Aventi, the former lawyer for Stormy Daniels, who was convicted of attempting to extort Nike. U.S. District Judge Sidney Stein, who was presiding over the trial, in March, rejected Menendez's arguments that his advocacy for the three businessmen was protected by the Constitution's speech and debate clause. Green, the Rutgers law professor, said the Supreme Court narrowed the definition of what constitutes an official act when tossing McDonald's corruption conviction in 2016. Some of what Menendez is alleged to have done, like setting up meetings and making contacts, may well fall within the scope of the McDonald exemption, he said, but it's hard to argue. It's hard to argue that other conduct, such as releasing holds on military sales and disseminating non-public information about embassy staffing, would not constitute official acts. Veteran New Jersey defense lawyer Joseph Hayden Jr. said he never thought a jury would convict Menendez in 2017 based on what he described as purely circumstantial evidence. But he remains skeptical that the new case against the senator is stronger than the last. One of the jurors in that trial told reporters after its conclusion that the jury leaned 10-2 toward acquitting Menendez because prosecutors had not provided smoking gun evidence, clearly establishing that he and Melgen had a corrupt agreement to exchange things of value for official acts. Bob Menendez is a fighter, Hayden said, and he's fighting this. Donald Trump on Saturday insulted the prosecutor who has charged him in his ongoing New York criminal trial, speaking at a large rally on the Jersey Shore, filled with personal attacks, coarse language, and vulgar expressions from the former president and his supporters. The presumptive Republican nominee called Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg Fat Alvin. He described New York Supreme Court Justice Juan Merchan, who is presiding over his trial, as highly conflicted, and he reprised his accusations that both are doing the bidding of President Biden, even though there is no evidence they have coordinated with Biden or his administration. The attacks were the latest show of defiance against judges and prosecutors from a candidate who is facing 88 criminal charges across 4 indictments. They were part of a flurry of broadsides or baseless claims that Trump and his backers launched during a beachside rally that marked a return to the campaign trail at the end of another week when Trump spent much of his time in a courtroom. He said he was indicted on bulls, prompting some in the crowd to repeat bulls in response. He attacked former New Jersey Republican Governor Chris Christie, winking at the audience, "You cannot call him a fat pig." As Trump berated the Biden administration, he asked the crowd everything they touch turns to what? "Shit," the crowd responded. "You can't use that word," Trump said, to laughs. At another point, as Trump complained about the news media, one rallygoer turned to the workspace for journalists yelling, "You guys suck, F fake news, go F yourselves." Thousands attended the event on a chilly evening, which marked a blue state detour for a candidate who is trying to balance his 4-day-a-week trial and running for president with about 6 months left until the election. The setting was a change of scenery from a typical Trump rally, but it included many of the same polarizing features of such a gathering that critics could have voiced alarm over, including attacks on undocumented immigrants whom he accused of staging an invasion as he vowed to stop the plunder, rape, slaughter, and destruction of the American suburbs, cities, and towns. He sharply derided his domestic critics and opponents, claiming the enemies from within are more dangerous to me than the enemies on the outside of the country. He praised the 6 Supreme Court justices who overturned Roe v. Wade, and he engaged in meandering asides, including about conversations he has had with celebrities or world leaders. Trump at one point told the crowd, "Let's talk about hot dogs. I just had one, actually," before he went on to discuss inflation. While Trump has spent the past week angrily complaining about his trial, he appeared to bask in the attention from his supporters on Saturday. He spoke surrounded by a roller coaster and Ferris wheel, complimenting his own remarks as a good speech and telling the crowd, "Do I feel comfortable with you? I love you." North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum, who has been discussed as a potential vice presidential candidate, spoke at the rally before Trump took the stage. Supporters lined up early in the day, standing in the sand, some wearing red hats and chanting, "Let's go, Brandon," a term used by some on the right to reference a profane attack on Biden. Many sat in white chairs on the sand, while others farther back brought beach blankets. The stores along the boardwalk in this predominantly white New Jersey shore town advertised Trump merchandise for those walking toward the rally. One woman working at a store on the boardwalk wore a blue sweatshirt that said, "Trump Strong," with red, white, and blue rhinestone hoops to match. Another attendee wore a white sweatshirt she brought that said, "This Jersey girl loves Trump. Get over it." Not since George H.W. Bush in 1988 has a Republican presidential candidate won New Jersey, and nonpartisan analysts regard it as a safe hold for Biden this fall. Yet, Cape May County, which includes Wildwood, has voted Republican in every presidential race going back to 2000. Trump performed better in Wildwood in 2016, winning the city by 35 points compared with 8 in 2020. He predicted Saturday that he would win the state of New Jersey. Trump last held a rally in Wildwood in January 2020, shortly after Republican Jeff Van Drew, who represents the area, switched from being a Democrat to a Republican. Trump's message then was similar to what it was Saturday. At that time, the Senate was holding Trump's first impeachment trial, and he said that Democrats are obsessed with demented hoaxes, crazy witch hunts. Trump advisors said they wanted to hold a rally in Wildwood in part because the South Jersey and Jersey Shore media market overlaps with Philadelphia's, allowing the campaign to reach voters in the battleground state of Pennsylvania. One advisor also noted New Jersey's proximity to New York, where the campaign is also considering holding a rally. That part of the state is very similar demographically to what you would see in other battleground states that has shifted, said Mike Duhame, a New Jersey native and longtime Republican strategist. Some Trump supporters attending the rally said they were paying some attention to the New York trial, but not following it closely. They echoed some of Trump's claims about the case, which centers on allegations of falsifying business records related to his repayment of attorney Michael Cohen for hush money to an adult film actress. And that's about all the time we have for this Monday. This is Claire Field signing off from the Washington Post.